Well, good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views. The views of our guests, and, well, this evening we have with us Catherine Albrecht, and I think you're going to find this a fascinating, fascinating subject. Now, of course, since the terrorist attack, and those of you who heard our program last night realize, of course, that the government knew that there were going to be terrorist attacks. They knew about the terrorist attack on TWA 800, but they had to suppress that from the American people. And then a couple of weeks later at the Olympics, when a terrorist bomb went off, of course, they arrested a man they knew was innocent, but they did everything they could to distract the American people from the terrorist threat, because that wasn't the time when we were going to launch the war on terrorism. Well, since September 11th of the year 2001, we live in a different world, and we find all sorts of government agencies out there collecting data. There was something called the Total Information Awareness Program brought forward by that great patron of virtue, Admiral Poindexter, who should be in prison for lying to Congress, but of course he is part of the ruling elite, and so he got off scot-free after lying and perjuring and doing all the other things that that people who are part of this invisible government do. But of course it was so interesting, this Total Information Awareness Program and the Pentagon had a logo. And it just happened to be a pyramid capped by an all-seeing eye. And that glorifying eye was looking out over the world. But it was the same emblem you find on the back of the dollar bill, on the back of the Great Seal of the United States. That same emblem that has been used by secret societies down through the ages. Well, our guest this evening has been very, very concerned about the fact that the government is collecting information on people by all sorts of means, and so I'm going to let her tell you what she has discovered about what happens when you go to your friendly grocery store and you buy discount groceries, or you think you're buying discount groceries with your grocery store card. Catherine, thanks so much for being with us again tonight.
It's great to be on with you again, Dr. Stan. Let me explain a little bit to your listeners what my research has taken me, or what roads my research has taken me down the last couple of years. In 1999, I founded an organization called Caspian, and that stands for Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering. I founded this organization in 1999 because I realized that most of us are carrying around a wallet full of plastic cards, and those plastic cards, each one of them represents a database of information being kept on you. Whatever transactions you engage in using those plastic cards are going into a database, and what's happened in the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years, since the early 1990s, when the grocery stores started issuing these frequent shopper or club cards or bonus cards, depending on what region of the country you're in. They go by a variety of different names, but essentially their purpose is all the same. It is a plastic card that you either carry in your wallet or on your keychain. Most of us are familiar with these cards, and every time you scan one of those cards, you think you're getting a discount. We can go into that a little bit later, the fact that many research studies have shown that you're actually paying higher prices by shopping at the stores with those cards. But you know, putting that aside for the moment, you think you're getting a discount, and most people don't look beyond the advertising hype that says, scan your card, join the club, we'll reward you with great deals and lower prices. What they don't realize is that when you scan that card, every single one of your purchases, all the way down to the very last Oreo cookie in your grocery basket, is being recorded in a database. Now, for many people in the United States, these databases now stretch back 5, 8, even 10 years in some cases, where now there is a longitudinal, that's a good researcher word for over time, looking over a period of many, many different years, at someone's behavior and seeing what they're doing over time. So now there exist these enormous, massive databases of information containing billions, probably at this point even trillions of lines of code, of all of the purchases that a vast majority of Americans have made at the grocery store over the last X number of years, or the last decade.
And, of course, that is on your name. You have a file. They're watching you.
That is correct. And what most people, particularly if they signed up in the early stages of these programs, did sign up honestly and sincerely with their full name, their full address. In many cases, and what most people don't remember, is that prior to about the year 2000, when a law went into effect in the state of California making this illegal, card stores or stores with these grocery store cards were requiring a social security number or a driver's license in order to even obtain a card. And I know this because on our website, which you can find online if you have access to a computer, at www.nocards, that's nocards.org, on our website at nocards.org, we have a list of over 400 supermarket chains around the United States. We list them according to whether or not they have a shopper card, what regions they're located in, and we have a link to their website so you can go check out their privacy policy or take a look at their sign-up application. On that website, we used to designate, in fact we still do, but we have for several years now designated whether they required ID or not to obtain the card. And in those early stages, I would estimate that at least half of them did require ID to get the card. So if you signed up for one before 2000, there's a good chance, whether you remember it or not, that you gave them your driver's license number as well. Now, many people, Dr. Stan, what they will do is they'll say, well, you know, I don't want my grocery store, you know, what do they need to know what brand of toilet paper I'm buying? I'm not going to sign up with my real name. I think I'll just sign up as George Orwell and, you know, I'll show them. Unfortunately, what's wrong with that tactic, first of all, the supermarkets love it. The supermarkets love that because they can get your data the moment you scan a credit card, an ATM card, or you pay with a check. They take your name right off the top of the credit card, right off the top of the bill. They throw out George Orwell or Mickey Mouse or whatever name you put on your card application, and your name goes right in that place. And making matters worse, let's say you've been shopping at that store for a year or two, paying cash every time carefully so that none of your information was linked to your card. The minute you do pay with a credit card, one day, you know, you do it accidentally, you do it without thinking, then bingo, all those previous records also get associated with your name.
They got you.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the reason I said that the supermarkets love that strategy is for two reasons. One is it gives people the false impression that they're protecting their privacy. And these stores know that people are very concerned about privacy in this day and age. And they don't want to tip their hand and let you know they're collecting the data. So, in fact, in some cases, Albertsons, particularly in the Northwest, up in the states of Washington and Oregon, has had an actual campaign where they'll openly say, and I believe they've even printed this on the card applications, they'll say, if you're not comfortable giving us your, you know, filling out the information in this form and giving us your name, we'll give you a card anyway. And, of course, what they don't say is, and then we'll gather your information anyway as soon as you pay with a credit card. So many people have been, deceived by this. I think that this almost falls under unfair, deceptive practices and should be legislated or should actually be prosecuted as a violation of the law. So there's some real serious concerns there. Now, I know many people are listening saying, well, wait a minute, you know, I've been shopping with my grocery store card. I thought I signed up anonymously. Now you're telling me I didn't. Well, what risks do I run now that all of this information has been collected on me? Well, let me give you a couple very specific things that have actually happened so far, and then I'll paint a few hypotheticals down the road. As far as specific abuses of this information, once it's been collected in the database, the term that I use is it hangs like ripe fruit for anyone who wants to come along and pluck it off the vine. Anytime you've got a database full of information, people come out of the woodwork looking for their particular cause or their particular reason to want it. A couple specific cases, there was a celebrated case in Southern California where a gentleman named Robert Rivera, who was a retired 65-year-old tow truck driver, slipped and fell on a yogurt spill that had been negligently left on the floor there. He shattered his kneecap and had to go into the hospital for kneecap replacement surgery, which at his age was a very painful and drawn-out procedure. When his attorneys, and by the way, he was not, you know, as a retired tow truck driver, he wasn't swimming in money, and I don't think he had a very good insurance plan. So his attorney said, well, you know, this is definitely negligence on the part of the supermarket. They have insurance that's specifically in place to take care of accidents like this that happen when we're not, you know, taking good care of the store, and that's who should pay for your medical bills. Well, when his attorney contacted Vons and was in the discovery process with the Vons attorneys, he claims that the attorneys for Vons, which, by the way, Vons is owned by Safeway, which is the second largest grocery chain in America. So this is a big company. Safeway is number three in America, number one being Kroger, number two being Albertsons. So here we've got the third largest grocery chain in America who says to this poor retired tow truck driver with all of his medical bills, if you proceed with this lawsuit, we will use the records of your alcohol purchases in our store against you in court. We will paint you as a falling down drunk to the judge, and you'll walk away without a penny. So you better settle out of court. So there's one example of a store very overtly attempting to use someone's shopper card records. Now, Vons, to be fair to them, they have denied this story. There's really no way of getting, I suppose, to the bottom of it because they did eventually settle the case out of court. But he maintains to this day that was the threat, and so does his attorney. Which doesn't surprise me given the next couple of things I'm going to say about these shopper card records, which are some other ways that they are routinely abused. Once the record is obtained, even if your grocery store wants to protect that information, they have a privacy policy that says we will never sell this information to third parties, we keep it strictly to ourselves, on and on in the lawyerese and the small print with all the assurances. Well, even if you trusted your grocery store to follow its own privacy policy, and in a moment we can talk privacy policies and why I don't believe in them or don't believe that they keep their promises. But let's say you did. Let's say you think Kroger is just a great corporation, you trust them, and you don't think they're going to use this information against you. Well, even if they want to protect your information, they cannot withhold it in the face of a warrant or a subpoena. And that is one of the other ways that this information is routinely falls into the wrong hands and is used against people. One example being a case cited in Michael Hyatt's book. You might remember Michael Hyatt. He was kind of big on the Y2K scene and wrote a book called Invasion of Privacy. And in that book, Invasion of Privacy, he cites the case of a gentleman whose supermarket card records were subpoenaed during an alimony dispute with his ex-wife. And her attorney got a hold of his records and said, well, hang on a second, we see that you've bought an expensive bottle of red wine. And anyone who could afford that kind of red wine certainly could afford more alimony than you're claiming, and used his shopper card records in front of the judge. In the UK, so there you've got an example of someone saying, well, hang on, look at this thing you bought. This indicates that you're not being perfectly honest about your income. This has not been lost on folks in England, where their version of the Internal Revenue Service routinely gets a hold of these records, subpoenas them, or I suppose the supermarkets just hand it over to them, which is what they do here often, and goes through the records and uses them to conduct the lifestyle audits to make sure that people's food consumption patterns match the income they report on their income taxes, which is a fairly incredible thought that someone would be combing through the type of food you're eating to make these sorts of determinations about you. It's not so surprising once you learn that AC Nielsen, those are the folks who do the big television ratings and rate a variety of different American consumer activities. AC Nielsen has published quite a bit of information about what it can tell about American households based on their grocery shopping patterns. And it's quite startling. Let me give you one example. They can tell if someone is a recent immigrant from Latin America. How could they tell? Because only recent immigrants from Latin America buy a certain quantity of soda, which I would assume to be a large amount of soda, and lard. So if you see people in certain parts of the country buying soda and lard, even if their last name, is Polnikov, there's a very good chance that you can pinpoint them down to being a recent Latin American immigrant. They even claim that they have these the sophisticated data programs that can go through your supermarket card record and determine almost down to the part of the country that you grew up in. If you've moved into the region you're living in from another state, they can actually even pinpoint it with that level of accuracy. So based simply on what you buy and what you feed your family, you would be astonished at the amount of information they can put together by inference based on simply the brand of orange juice you buy, the kind of toothpaste you buy. I was just reading something today saying that Colgate is a brand preferred by Hispanics. Who would have guessed? So when they put certain things together, they can make certain inferences about the racial makeup of your household. They can make inferences, obviously, about who lives in your house, if you're buying diapers, if you're buying denture cleaner, if you're buying cat food, dog food, those quantities of food that you're buying, the time of day that you're doing your shopping. If you're shopping consistently at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a good chance you're working a graveyard shift. If you're shopping consistently during certain hours, then they can tell you're working a 9-to-5. It's astonishing. Now, if that weren't enough, what they can tell simply based on what you've bought at the grocery store, they have this other product called a penetration profile. It's a wonderful, awful name. What a penetration profile is it's actually where the supermarket can go outside of its own database and purchase a whole host of additional information about the individual shoppers in their database. So, for example, they can go to, there's a company called AccuData, A-C-C-U-D-A-T-A. AccuData sells these penetration profiles to grocery stores to augment the information in the database with a whole host of, I believe, psychographic characteristics is one of the ways they describe it. What that means is that your local Kroger, Albertsons, Safeway, whatever it is, can go to AccuData and say, here's our list of customers. Can you tell us if any of them are in your database? And then they will say, oh, yes, why, as a matter of fact, we have a certain percentage of those. Here's their data. Now pay us a nice, you know, sum of money, and we will give you information ranging from who their telephone providers are, how much their mortgage is, what's the make and model of their car, how many children they have, where they take their vacations, what their dress sizes are, unbelievable amounts of information. So when you put all of this together, and believe me, I'm just scratching the surface here, when you put all of this together, you wind up with an extraordinary amount of data collection and data exchanging, selling, trading that's going on behind the scenes of American commerce that I think most Americans really have no conception that this is going on. And in fact, about a year ago, I wrote an article for the Denver Law Review. And the title of the article, I think, sums up what I've learned over the years. I titled the article, Supermarket Cards, Tip of the Retail Surveillance Iceberg. And I coined the term retail surveillance to represent a whole host of technologies of which the supermarket card is only the visible component. It's the one piece. We all know the supermarket card. We all see them dangling off each other's keychains or in our wallets. I say our figuratively because, of course, I don't have one of these. But, you know, you see them everywhere we go. Some estimates say that as many as 70 or 80% of U.S. households are participating in a supermarket card program of one sort or another. So we see these everywhere. What we don't realize, and the next time you look at one of them, is I want you to visually picture an iceberg. You've got the little, you know, top 10% floating above the surface is the supermarket card, but underneath that you've got this massive data collection infrastructure, which comprises a big 90% that you don't see.
Now, of course, what about the selling this to HMOs or medical insurance companies so that can be used against you to restrict your access to health care?
Yeah, and there's a pretty chilling case of this. The latest Enron-type accounting scandal involves an international grocery chain called Royal Ahold. It's spelled A-H-O-L-D. They're based out of the Netherlands, and they're called Royal because over there, I guess the Netherlands government, if they really think you're great, they'll stick Royal in front of your name. So we've got this company called Royal Ahold. They own an enormous infrastructure of food distribution in this country. They own U.S. Food Service, which supplies restaurants, places like Red Apple, and a whole bunch of restaurants and places I'm sure we've all heard of. They also own supermarket chains. One of the biggest supermarket chains they own is one called Stop and Shop, which is the biggest grocery chain here in the East Coast, particularly here in New England where I am. Stop and Shop Stop and Shop vice president made an announcement at a talk last year that they were planning on handing over all of their shopper card data to HMOs as a cost-saving measure. And am I hearing break music coming up?
Yes, here? You're hearing the break music.
Well, stay tuned because I'll give you the details on how the HMOs want to get a hold of our information next.
All right, fine. We'll be back in just a couple of moments. Now, Catherine is actually writing her doctoral thesis at Harvard on this subject. She is certainly not just a casual actor here. She's very well informed, probably the best informed person I've run into on this information. They're collecting data on you. And we'll be back in just a moment or two to tell you more about this incredible, incredible story. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our listeners up in the Great Northwest are going to be away from us for about 4 minutes, and during that period of time, I just want to tell you a little story, and when we get back, they get join us again, then we'll want to pick up on this story of how this information, our shopping information, can be used against you. But we have a four-tape set, we call it China, and basically two of the tapes are talks that were given by a man named Reverend Millian, who was in communist China at the time of the communist takeover. And the first tape is really a vivid description of what it was like living in a Chinese community after, of course, the nationalist troops had retreated and the communist troops had come in. And of course, as the communist troops came into the city, they said everybody was to be in front of their little enclave, and Reverend Millen was running an orphanage for children, and so he was to be outside in the front to greet the communist officers when they came into town. If you didn't come out to greet them, of course, you would be arrested. So he went out and was very polite. And of course, they immediately sent a squad or two of soldiers into his house, into his bedroom, and they began counting his shirts. And they came out and they said, "Reverend Millen, you're supposed to have 9 shirts and you only have 7 shirts there. What happened to the other 2? And what, of course, shocked him so much was somebody working in his household had been counting the number of shirts that he had. You only have 17 pair of socks. You should have 19 pair of socks. What happened to the other socks?" Well, he told them they'd worn out and they'd thrown them away. Well, of course, to the Chinese, is incomprehensible. You would throw a shirt away or a pair of socks. You would just simply repair them over and over again. They knew everything that he had in his house. They knew how many typewriters he had. They knew every detail about him because they had been spying on him. They had been keeping records on him so that once they, of course, came to power, they would be able to use the information they knew about him to intimidate him and let him know, of course, that he was really nothing at all, that he really belonged to them. And as I listened to that story, I first heard it some 40 years ago, one of the most gripping presentations I've ever heard. And if you haven't heard our 4-tape set on China, let me suggest that you get it and listen to it. It will really give you a whole different perspective of what happened in China and perhaps give you an understanding of what's going on in America today as we prepare to move towards this total surveillance society, a totally surveillance state. Of course, here in the United States, it's being sold in the name of, oh, we're fighting terrorism. But of course, we're really not fighting terrorism. The major funder of the or source of funding for Al-Qaeda has always been Saudi Arabia, and our government is blocked doing everything they can to block the suits of the families of the victims of 9/11 against Saudi Arabia, and they're still funding Al-Qaeda. Of course, our borders remain open. We're allowing people to come into this country. Only within the last couple of weeks have they actually begun to require interviews with the people coming into this country from Saudi Arabia, and for a year and a half they've been allowing people to come in from the country that provided 15 of the 19 terrorists come to America without even requiring an interview, which is of course required by law. So perhaps there's something wrong with this whole idea of the war on terrorism. Is it really a war on terrorism, or is it possibly an effort to justify what we're seeing today? And that is massive gathering of information on every American in the name of fighting terrorism. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Catherine Albrecht. And of course, her website is www.nocards.org or cassandra.org. And of course,
No, it would be Caspian, but we actually don't own that domain, unfortunately.
Oh, you don't?
Yeah, our organization is called Caspian, but someone else beat us to that, but we are online at nocards.org.
Okay, at Caspian. So, okay, fine. Well, let's get back. And you were going to tell our listeners about, of course, how the information that's being gathered can be used by the health maintenance organizations and other health insurance companies. Now, when people are, of course, going to the grocery store, they're having no idea that these files are being kept on them or that this information could be used against them. So what's this all about?
Well, a couple years back, the Stop and Shop chain that I mentioned before the break, which is it's a very large multinational corporation. It's one of the 10 biggest grocery chains in America, and the biggest grocery chain on the East Coast. Stop and Shop invested $3 million to create a program called Smart Mouth, SMARTMOUTH, like, you know, you have a smart mouth. The idea being that they would collect all of this information, they would create this software, this sophisticated software program, to convert all of the shopper information they had collected from every time people use their cards, turn those records into detailed individual nutritional and health profiles on Stop and Shop customers. So what they did, literally, you could, and this program was actually online for a certain period of time because they were hoping people would love it. People would go online, they'd pull up the website, they'd go to Stop and Shop's website, they would type in the number from the back of their card, and right there on the screen would be a record of their shopping visits, what they had purchased, and more disturbingly, a little pull-down menu that would say, check me for how I'm doing on cholesterol. And ding, 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 the little program would go through, look at everything you bought, calculate its cholesterol level, and say, boy, you know, you're a walking heart attack waiting to happen. Or it would say, check me on sodium, or check me on vegetable, whatever it was. You could pull down and find out all of this information. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story, because I think this is indicative of how these things work. I was contacted by a reporter who asked me to give my opinion on it. Well, of course, I don't have a Stop and Shop card. I refuse to shop at stores that have these cards. And I recommend all of your listeners boycott them as well. Why reward them with your hard-earned shopping dollars if they're going to be doing these practices? So in any event, I don't have a Stop and Shop card, but I wrote an email to a friend of mine who I thought might. And he wrote me back and said, yeah, and I said, you know, can you give me your Stop and Shop number? I want to check this out. So he wrote me back with the number, and I poked around the website. And I'm telling you, I felt like I was going through my poor friend's, you know, like the drawers in his desk. I mean, it was disgusting. I knew, you know, I was thinking to myself things like, huh, I wonder what he was doing at the store at 2 in the morning on a Tuesday. Doesn't he have to be at work the next year? I was thinking, boy, I didn't know he ate junk food like that. Well, what was he buying? Pickles and, you know. So I was going through in my head. I was trying to fight the tendency. But, boy, when you're looking at all this data, you know, all these thoughts come in your head. And, afterwards, I poked around. I talked to the reporter. And I got back to him. And I said, you know, I really felt terrible doing that. You know, I want to apologize to you. He said, oh, don't apologize to me. He said, it's no big deal. That wasn't my account. I copied the number off of a guy's keychain at work when he wasn't looking. So there were no security controls on this. There was no access control. Anyone could copy anybody's number off of their keychain. You know, and if you've ever been to the health club or a restaurant or out with a friend, you know, people leave their keys lying out on the table. They've got these little cards sitting there. You could easily jot down that 10-digit number. In fact, an ex-boyfriend or a jealous, angry ex-husband or somebody could copy down that number and use it to, you know, find out, gee, I wonder if my ex-wife or my ex-girlfriend or my ex-boyfriend or ex-husband is out buying, you know, red wine and flowers. You know, the ramifications of making this information available are really quite chilling. But here's the real kicker of the story, is they pulled the website down after just a couple of months of having it up. And when Kurt Avalon, who is the vice president for marketing and new technology for Stop and Shop, was asked, why did you get rid of the Smart Mouth program? His answer was, people were horrified to discover how much information we had amassed on them. And by making it publicly accessible to them, it scared them. So we pulled it offline, and he said, you know what, because most people, we found out, most people don't even realize we collect the data, and it's probably better that way.
It's probably better that way, and of course, the frightening thing, though, is that health insurance companies or anybody would have access to that, and if you are, of course, eating wrong or you're taking in too much cholesterol, why, of course, they could certainly use that to exclude you from a policy, couldn't they?
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head, because the next question Kurt Avalon was asked was, well, so what are you going to do about all the money you invested in that? He said, well, yeah, we spent $3 million to get that program. We're hoping to get some of that money back by sharing this data with, forming an alliance with 2 or 3 HMOs. And the forming the alliance part's important because their policy says they won't sell it. It doesn't say they won't share it with partners. So if they form an alliance by signing a contract, they can give them anything they want.
We're going to be right back in just a moment with Catherine. And if you have a question, give us a call here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Catherine Albrecht, and of course her website is www.nocards.org. That's nocards.org, and we're simply talking about the fact that they are gathering all of this information. Of course, now the people go because these are discount cards. The only trouble is Well, are these really discount cards, or do they raise the price, and then, of course, I say, well, of course, you're going to get it cheaper if you've got one of our cards, if you're part of our club. How does that really work, and what have they found out when they've analyzed the prices at these stores that are collecting data on their customers?
Well, there was a fascinating study that came out in January through the Wall Street Journal, and we actually had a hand in that because Caspian, our organization that's been opposing these grocery store cards since 1999, has done a number of our own somewhat informal surveys, some of them with quite a number of products, though. And we have found in all of our surveys that every time we compare the stores with the cards to the stores without the stores with the cards cost you an awful lot more money. And I get thousands of emails pouring into my mailbox from people around the country who have observed the same thing, particularly right after a program goes in. They'll say, well, you know, I used to be able to buy this item for 99 cents, and sometimes it would be on sale for 79 cents. Now it's $1.50, and it's on sale for 99 cents. So where's the savings here? I have to use a card to get the price I was already paying before. Well, in January of this year, the Wall Street Journal did its own study based on some suggestions. We actually talked to them and said, you know, you guys need to check this out. Well, they went to five different cities across America. And in each city, I believe they compared two to three different grocery stores in their price comparison. And in every single case, the stores with the cards came out higher than the competitor right down the street that did not have a card program. So when the card program, you know, when the advertisement says, you sign up for our card, you'll save a whole bunch of money, what they mean is you'll save money over the non-card price we're going to skin people with if they don't sign up for our card. It doesn't mean you'll save money over the store down the street. Now, I did my own, I recently did one for NBC Boston, a price comparison where I went to my local chain. We've got a wonderful family-owned chain of about 60 stores called Market Basket here in New Hampshire, Massachusetts. And down the street, there's a big national chain or part of a big multinational company actually called Shaw's that does have a card. I compared at both stores. I bought the exact same eight items at all of which were supposedly on sale at Shaw's, the card store. Without the card, I paid $17 for those items, meaning that that should be the going rate. With the card, I paid $13 for those items. So I saved, and it said, you know, congratulations, by using your card, you saved $4. I'm rounding all these to the nearest dollar. So it said, congratulations, you saved $4 by using your card, so you think you're getting a good deal. Well, I went down the street to my wonderful family-owned Market Basket store and bought the exact same items, the total $11. Now, these were not just any hand-picked items that I picked to try to make this result. These were literally items, all of which were on sale at the card store at Shaw's, many of which were not on sale at my local store. So even when you compare, in many cases, the sale prices at the card stores with the everyday prices at the card-free stores, you find a better deal at the card-free store. Now, why is that? Because it costs millions of dollars to run and implement these programs. You have to hire data entry people. You have to hire people to run these massive, enormous databases. You cannot imagine what amount of infrastructure it takes to record every item in every shopping basket going through every lane of every checkout of every store in your chain, especially if you're a big chain like Kroger, which has over 2,000 stores. So the amount of infrastructure and investment in this is absolutely massive. Why would they spend all of that money? There's two reasons. One is so they can raise the prices. There is a big psychological impact on shoppers if you can say to them, we saved you money. Think about the example I just gave you. You pay $17 without the card. You pay $13 with it. You save $4. Well, most people, what they probably should be writing at the bottom of the receipt is, ha-ha, we just ripped you off $2 what you would have paid down the street. But what they say instead is, we saved you money. For most shoppers, the psychological impact of that is quite powerful. People, when they think that they're saving money, when they see you saved $4 by using their card, they believe it. I mean, most of us, we don't believe most people are lying to us most of the time. Most of us are, I think human beings tend, on the whole, to be rather trusting. And studies have shown repeatedly over the years that the supermarket is the most trusted retail channel in America. So people really do trust their supermarkets. And I'm here to tell you, you should not trust your supermarket. Your supermarket may well be your worst enemy. But people on the whole tend to think of supermarkets as sort of homey, you know, friendly people who just want to feed, you know, help you feed your family. They're dealing with a very homey sort of comfort, you know, mom and apple pie kind of product, which is food. You know, and all of us sort of relate to that on a very primal, basic level. And we really do want to think about our supermarkets as being our friends. So even, you know, so when they say we saved you $4, most people say, well, you know, that was nice of you. What they don't think is that, wait a minute, let me compare that down the street. So all of those studies, the Wall Street Journal study was followed. It made a big splash in the, in the news industry, because we were later contacted, and I'm personally aware of, I would say, at least 15 or 20, probably even more like two dozen studies that have been done by various NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox affiliate television stations, a number of local newspapers, in cities all over the country, states all around the country. And in almost every case, I would say in every case except for one or two of all of the comparisons, which are probably more than 100 when you look at all the stores, in every case other than one or two, the card store was more expensive than the non-card store. So you're not saving money. And let me give you one more example to just bring that home. In Waco, Texas, back about a year and a half ago, when Albertsons first reneged on its no cards, no hassles promise, if you have an Albertsons in your area, you'll know what I'm talking about. Albertsons, the second largest grocery chain in America, went back on a long-standing promise to not have cards and not hassle their customers with them, and they introduced a card. Well, I'm telling you, customers hated this card. They turned out in droves. We actually organized protests that were covered by all the major media. We had people marching in the streets, holding up signs, you know, saying Albertsons has gone to the dark side. I mean, people were really upset about this. And when a newspaper reporter went into an Albertsons in Waco, Texas, she found that they had the nerve to take a product, this particular product was Kraft Velveeta cheese, and that's one of the few products that still has a manufacturer suggested retail price printed on the Kraft, you know, on the label at the Kraft factory of $3.99. Well, Albertsons had the nerve to put on its label, on the little shelf sticker, Kraft cheese, Velveeta cheese, $5.99, everyday low price. But if you use your card, you'll get $2 off, and it'll be $3.99. So that's just an example where the customer, you know, even the customers who aren't paying attention couldn't help but notice that little discrepancy. What about all the products that don't have the manufacturer suggested retail price printed on the package? We have found that they're doing that over and over repeatedly. So I got onto this saying that the stores are spending a massive amount of money funding these programs. Why are they doing it? Number one, it lets them raise prices and lets them have the customers who are having the prices raised on them thanking them all the way to the cash register. The second reason they want to do it is they want to collect your data. Why? Well, it's actually becoming quite complex. The reason they want the data now is to do something, this latest trend called customer segmentation. And it's based on a realization the grocery industry made probably about 10, 15 years ago now, that the upper 30% of their customers, that's the elite, the upper crust of grocery shoppers, accounted for 70% of their overall profits. When they made that realization, they said to themselves, well, we need to identify who those people are, and we need to treat them really well. And conversely, we need to identify who's at the bottom tier of our customers and maybe even discourage them from coming into the store. And when I say discouraged, I mean literally discouraged. They're actually using longitudinal, this is long-term shopper card data, to identify the type of shopper that they don't want in their store. One industry consultant went so far as to call shoppers who don't spend, who don't contribute a lot of profit at the grocery store, to actually call them bottom feeders. And another industry consultant said, yeah, the Albertsons preferred customer card, that's preferred customer is a good name, as in prefer you don't shop here. We use this information to identify you and keep you out. And I just did a New Hampshire Public Radio debate just last week. In fact, it's still online. If you want to go to nhpr.org, you can listen to a debate I did with a man named Marty Abrams on target marketing. And Marty Abrams is a total proponent of all of this data collection. And he actually had a quote that said, using this information, we can identify these low profit consumers, and we can keep them out of the store through higher prices and poor service. And then he said a critic of this practice, which I am not, meaning he's not a critic of it, but a critic of this practice would call it digital redlining. And I thought, boy, what an accurate term for what they're starting to do now. So, again, the reason they're spending this enormous amounts of money, $70 million in the case of one chain that recently dismantled its program and revealed what it was spending. So $70 million a year, give or take, is going in for each of these stores, each of these chains, to keep this data on us. They're doing it because they want to raise the prices. They want to psychologically soothe you into thinking you're getting a deal. They want to collect data on you. And finally, they want to identify whether you're the kind of bottom feeder they want to keep out of their store through poor service and higher prices, or whether you're the kind of elite shopper that they want to attract in there, that they want to roll out the red carpet for. And even if you are that elite shopper they're going to roll out the red carpet for, which I think most of us probably aren't, but let's say you are and you think, well, you know, hey, it's worth it for a couple of good deals. Believe me, once you've been identified as one of those desirable shoppers, your information is collected like mad, and it is shared with everybody under the sun because everybody wants a piece of your wallet. So no matter who you are, this works to your disadvantage, whether it's through higher prices or privacy invasion.
Well, now, of course, is this information available to the government?
Well, that's the next piece with the Total Information Awareness Program that you talked about at the opening of the program, which, by the way, is now being renamed the Terrorist Information Program.
Isn't that nice? They figure that by changing the name, the American people won't understand what they're really doing.
Well, you know, I just feel so much safer now that I know they're only tracking the grocery records of terrorists, cough, cough, but... It's terrible. Well, the idea behind the Total Information Awareness Program, for your listeners who aren't familiar with it, is it is an attempt or a project put out by the Department of Defense and a whole bunch of folks at the highest levels of our government, Homeland Security, et cetera, to claim that they have to have access to all commercial databases being kept on Americans, and that they want to put these round-the-clock data sort of observer programs on each one of us, kind of an electronic tail, as it were, to keep an eye on everything we're doing, looking for anything unusual or out of the ordinary. And, of course, if something unusual comes up, like, you know, you normally don't shop at 2 a.m., and there you are at the store at 2 a.m. buying, you know, pita bread and hummus, maybe you've suddenly, you know, turned into a radical terrorist, who knows, and then that would flag someone to take a closer look at your file and look at all of the other related files that are being kept on you, which would include things like your library card records. Of course, now they have the right to access that without telling you, without a warrant, without, you know.
So they can determine what books you're reading and what you're thinking, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it really, if you think about, there's a little exercise I recommend people do, which is pull all the cards out of your wallet and take a look at them one by one and realize that every one of them tells where you've been, tells probably in many cases even who you are with, because maybe somebody else scanned their card near the same time you were. If you have a bus pass, it's scanning when you get on and off the bus. If you have a Kinko's card, I suppose all of that could ultimately be linked into the database. So what we're seeing is that all of these databases, which are currently separate, right now your Kinko's database, your library card, your shopper card, your grocery store card, your phone card, all this stuff is now kept in separate databases. The push behind Total Information Awareness, or now Terrorist Information Awareness, is to remove the barriers between those databases and consolidate them into one master database that would be keeping track of literally everything we did.
Well, let me just counter that. But now, as long as I'm a law-abiding citizen, why should I be concerned if the government is keeping a dossier on me, as long as I'm a law-abiding citizen?
Well, I'm glad you're asking that question. I have a whole host of answers to that. Folks with access to the Internet, I would suggest you head by nocards.org. I have an FAQ section on there where I have sort of some philosophical musings about the value of privacy. That's for people of a more esoteric or philosophical bent, but most people are practical at heart. And let me give you a couple practical reasons why this is a bad plan. First, and I think most importantly, is what it does to society. At what cost are we sacrificing our privacy, and at what cost are we allowing this type of information to be gathered about us? And on that, I will draw from my insight as a doctoral student in psychology at Harvard University, where I have been studying the psychology of consumers in a world where their privacy is being invaded. And I've come to some pretty fascinating insights in the literature and research studies that have been done over the years. two things that I think from that literature would be interesting to people. First of all, the effects of not having privacy on a person's psychological well-being are extraordinarily damaging. Most people don't realize it because we live in a world where we are steeped with having our privacy invaded. But the cost of that is a high degree of stress. It's a high degree of nervousness. In some cases, it can actually lead to psychotic behavior when they've observed it. It doesn't even necessarily have to be that the information that's being gathered about you is used against you. It's simply the fact of being watched. And human beings, we are very social creatures. We're very much in tune to what other people think about us, like it or not, no matter how independent we think we are. We always do care, whether it's caring what everybody thinks or what a few select people think. All of us are sort of imbued with that social awareness. And the idea that we would be watched, that we would never have an opportunity to let our hair down and let go and be ourselves, not necessarily doing anything wrong. I think some of the examples I give on the website in the FAQ section at nocards.org are, do you paint mustaches on supermodels in the magazines when you read them? Or do you mop the kitchen floor wearing a Superman cape? Or do you belt out tunes, songs out of tune in the shower? Do you bite your toenails? These are all things that, if you do, maybe that's a little weird, but it's certainly none of my business, and it's nobody else's business either.
But of course, increasingly, the government is asking citizens to report on other citizens. In fact, they wanted a system almost like block wardens, like they had in communist Cuba or East Germany. Fortunately, there was quite an outcry on that, but I suspect as things get worse and people become increasingly fearful, they will be willing to begin to inform on their neighbors. And then, of course, all that information, you might be a terrorist, maybe you're not, but you might be a terrorist. So let's start going through all the information we can collect on you and where you are. We know where you are when you use your cell phone. Every telephone call you make is recorded. Everybody you call is recorded. All that information, everything you say, certainly is being monitored through Echelon, through the records of your emails that they're keeping, the faxes that you send. All of this, of course, is available, and you might actually say something that could be misconstrued that would suggest that you were anti-government. That, of course, in itself could become a crime in a country that is faced with a terrorist threat.
Well, Dr. Stan, you've now hit the second of the two reasons why I think it's just a horrible idea to be doing this. The first, of course, being simply psychological well-being, not only of individuals, but of society as a whole. And you start to see the breakdown of the social fabric when you have a world where everybody is under that kind of constant surveillance stress. The second reason is one that you just hit on. And I realize most people listening to this radio program, Radio Liberty, I would hope that most of you already have a sort of burning love of liberty somewhere in your hearts, which is what brought you to this program and has brought you repeatedly to all the valuable information that Dr. Stan brings to you. So I know I'm kind of preaching to the choir. And realizing that I'm doing that, my goal in being on this program is to really give you some intellectual ammunition that you can take out there as you're talking to friends, neighbors, family members who don't get it. And explain to them, hey, wait a minute, literally when you scan that grocery store card, you're leaving yourself open for abuses. Here's another one I want to put out there, and this is something that, this is a wonderful little tool you can use. When people say to you, I think it's a great idea that we're being surveilled at every turn. I think it's a great idea that they're keeping track of where people go and what they buy and using all these surveillance cameras to capture images of them because it's going to make us so much safer. The sentence always ends with more secure, it's better security, and we will be safer. Now, how do you counter that as a person who loves liberty? You know in your heart it's wrong. You can feel in your bones that it's wrong. You can feel in your gut that we are not getting safer. We are getting more and more at risk. How do you put that into words? Well, the thing I've hit on, as I have said in response to that in a number of television and radio interviews I've done recently, is I have said, let's take a look historically, and I'm also a student of history, particularly 20th century history, when we've had so much brutality on the part of awful dictators and horrible regimes. So let's take a look at 20th century history. Who were the most surveilled people on the earth? The most surveilled people on the planet were the citizens of Stalinist Russia, of the Soviet Union, where every phone call was monitored. Every letter potentially could be intercepted. Every neighbor was reporting potentially on every other neighbor. Everywhere you went, you ran the risk of being reported on. Every word you said could be overheard. So there's a perfect example of, if you want to say, well, gee, we're going to be so safe. Were people safe in communist Russia? That's the question. And if you take a look at a book, anyone who wants some good intellectual ammunition, there's a book by a man named R.J. Rummel. I believe it's R-U-M-M-E-L-L or L-L. Anyway, R.J. Rummel wrote a book called Death by Government. It's a fantastic book in that it's not a page-turner you'd sit down and read. It's really filled with statistics. But he is a professor. I believe he's in Hawaii. He's a researcher, and he has looked extensively at genocides and governments killing their own people in the 20th century. And it is an absolutely, conversation stopper. I've said to many people, I work with a lot of younger people, or young adults, and I'll say to them, what has killed more people in the 20th century than anything else? And they'll say, alcohol, drugs, crime. You'll say, no, actually, far outstripping them beyond any imaginable conception is people's own government. Has been the number one killer of people on this planet in the 20th century. And for all I know, it's been that way for forever. I don't know. But
I think
in the 20th century. Yeah, it's been very well documented, at least in Dr. Rummel's work.
And of course, our founding fathers feared government. They realized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, and that's why they restricted the power of government. And where did we get away from that? Little bit by little bit, our freedom is progressively eroded. We've got Bill calling from Coeur d'Alene. Bill, we're almost out of time. Do you have a quick question?
Just a quick question to your guest, if she could comment on RFIDs.
What's RFID?
Oh, yeah, let me talk to that. Thank you for bringing that up, Bill. RFID stands for Radio Frequency Identification Technology. Dr. Stan, I hope you have me back on at some point. I would like to actually devote a full hour to this topic.
You can come on anytime. You're one of my favorite guests, really.
Go ahead. Thank you very much. You're one of my favorite radio hosts, so it's mutual. RFID is Radio Frequency Identification Devices. They are tiny chips the size of a speck of dust, in fact, smaller than a speck of dust, which there is a global move afoot right now to embed these tiny devices into all consumer products manufactured on the globe. These devices will replace the barcode. They contain a unique identifying number, meaning that every item on the globe will have its own number. For those of you with a biblical bent, that should concern you. More disturbingly still, these items can be tracked and read at a distance. So what this means is that if you are wearing and carrying a whole bunch of things that are equipped with these tiny tags, every time you pass by a reader device, which is a little passive thing that can be hidden in a doorway, in a floor tile, in a place you wouldn't even know it was there, every time you pass by one of those, an electronic inventory can be made of everything you're wearing and carrying. This relates the RFID technology, the radio frequency technology, is also related to the VeriChip, that is the implantable identification device being put out by Applied Digital Solutions. Some may know it as the Digital Angel device. It operates on a similar technology, which is basically that you would have something in you, on you, in a product, on a product, woven into your clothing, in your, whatever it is you're carrying, that would be readable from a distance. If that's in a human being, it means that human being can be identified at a distance. It means that that chip can be used to make transactions or to make payments. Again, people with a little bit of biblical information under their belt should be a little concerned about that, because that very closely matches the description of the mark of the beast as described in Revelation 13. The most recent development on RFID, there's been two developments on this technology. One was that Italian clothing manufacturer Benetton made an announcement in February that they were going to begin putting these into their clothing. There was an international outcry, which our organization Caspian was at the head of. We have a domain or a website on that called boycottbenetton.org. I would recommend anybody who's interested in the RFID issue to check that out. Boycott, two T's, Benetton, two T's, .org. The outcry from that was so overwhelming that Benetton pulled back from their plans to put these chips into their clothing devices. In the intervening months, several other companies have stepped forward and will be doing this, including Michelin, who wants to put these tracking devices in tires, which would mean that cars could be trackable. You could put a reader device in a road and detect every car that drove past it or into a neighborhood or down a freeway. You could tell where cars were at all times if you equipped all cars with this. Gillette has put these devices in its shaving products, which it is distributing through Walmart stores. Walmart is in this technology up to its eyebrows. They are one of the key sponsors and funders of this technology. And there are a number of folks in Europe now who are dabbling with it as well. There is a conference coming up that I will be attending in June that I will come back from that with quite a bit more information about who the key players are and what's going to be happening with that. In the meantime, we are so far the only consumer organization that has taken a very public stand against this. And anyone out there who is listening who would like to join us in that, we desperately need volunteers to work with us to protest these businesses and to get the word out about this RFID technology.
I think that's so very important. Thanks very much. We're going to have to let Bill go, and let's go quickly to Tony. We're just about out of time. Tony, you got 30 seconds.
Okay, Applied Digital Solutions, Doctor, is no longer part of the Digital Angel Group, because when I called, I did a story on the company, and when I called and talked to Digital Angel directly, they said they were breaking away or separating from Applied Solutions.
All right,
and,
fine.
They didn't give me any reason for it, but it sounded kind of mysterious
because they just got public. Let's see what Catherine has to say.
Thank you so very much. I haven't been following the ownership of that company. What I have been following, though, are its financial ups and downs. Now, Applied Digital Solutions is a very, how would I put it? They're kind of a hokey company. to put it bluntly, they don't really have their act together. What concerns me, though, is they've taken out quite a bit of loan funding, and much of that is through some very big companies. I believe IBM was involved in this at one stage. And so the question is whether they will be able to financially remain afoot. They've been on shaky ground for a while. If they go under, then their technology could be subsumed by a very large corporation, in which case we might really be in trouble. Applied Digital Solutions so far, I think, has gotten fewer than 24 people worldwide to sign up for their implantable chip. So they really are a losing proposition right now. They're not making any money. They are having a hard time getting people to volunteer for these chips. But if somebody like IBM comes along and takes them over, and then we have, a few more years of this homeland security where everybody wants to, you know, monitor everybody else, and it could just be a matter of time before they do begin shipping people in earnest. So I would definitely keep my eye on the company, and thanks for the heads up that they may be splitting off, and I'll look into that further.
Well, Tom is calling us from Spokane, but we're not going to have time to take Tom's call. We just want to thank you so very much for being with us. And would you suggest that people let the grocery store with those cards know exactly how they feel about what they're doing?
Well, I'd say there's a couple things you can do. First, I don't want to paint such a bleak picture. I am sensing, because I do quite a bit of media, I am sensing, and I get thousands of emails, that people are not as anti. They don't care as little about privacy as you would be led to believe in the mainstream media. There are millions of us who care about these issues. I would say what we need to do is band together. I would encourage anybody who cares about this issue to join us, join the resistance movement against all of this tracking. NoCards.org, there's a feedback form there. I would welcome you to sign up, become a member. It's free. You'll get our newsletter. We'll keep you posted of activity in your area. And please volunteer. Help us out. Let's fight back.
God bless you. Thanks very much, Catherine.
Thank you, Dr.
We will call you and get you on those other programs. Give me a call tomorrow if you have, and we'll pre-record a program for our weekend.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye-bye.
And this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our men overseas. And please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. We look forward to hearing from you. Until tomorrow night, Dr. Stan, good night. And may the Lord be with you. this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we, of course, ask you to hold your calls for the time being because, well, we're going to start out with Randy Thomason of the Campaign for California Families. And Randy is, of course, going to give us a rundown on what's happening up in Sacramento. Then we'll have Brad Dacus on, and then we're going to have Vernon Bohr, and we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the efforts to pass bonds for school boards. And although this may not be a lot of interest to people out throughout the country, the things that happen in California really foreshadow what happens in the rest of the world, because California is a bellwether state, and as California goes, so goes the nation, and right now California is going right down the tubes. Randy, how are you?
Hi, Dr. Stan. It's good to be with you. Hope you can hear me all right. I'm on my cell phone.
All right, you go ahead.
Well, yes, and thank you for doing what you do and reaching all the people that you reach. And, well, you know, we're 1 week away from a terrible, terrible bill. Let's see. It's a bill that would obliterate the definition of marriage, man and a woman only. It would trample the vote of the people. And it would literally create homosexual marriage in California. The bill is AB 205. And we talked about this before, Dr. Stan. What is your opinion of this?
Well, all I can say is that God cannot be happy when he sees what's happening, and God will not be mocked indefinitely.
That is right. And so we have seen the people of California rise up to answer a question on the ballot 3 years ago. Should marriage only be for a man and a woman? And they said yes, overwhelmingly said yes. And now we need the people of California to rise up again with a sense of righteous indignation and say that marriage is a sacred institution. It should not be turned into two men together or two women together, because if you actually do that, why not three people together? And why not get rid of the age limitations and so forth? And why not children? I mean, it can get very, very crazy. You read reports from other countries about a woman who married her TV. This actually occurred in Australia. It was a strange, crazy judge. Another man married his dog. Again, lousy judges doing these things. But the people need to rise up and need to speak against this. And Dr. Stan, I'd like to have a phone number for your California listeners along the Central Coast. It's very important to call Rebecca Cohn. She wants to be state senator for the Central Coast area, Monterey County, and so forth. And she can be reached at the following number. I hope you take down this number and give her a call and urge her to oppose AB 205. Now, Rebecca Cohn is in the state assembly. Again, she wants to run for higher office all the way down through the Central Coast. Her number is 916-319-2028, 916-319-2028. Excuse me, that's for Simone Salinas. You can call him, too. But the correct number for Rebecca Cohn is 916-319-2024. So please give her a call tomorrow, this week definitely. Urge her to oppose AB 205 and simply explain that AB 205 awards all the rights of marriage under California law to homosexual couples. That reverses the vote of the people. Tell her, do not reverse my vote. It's very important to say that. Dr. Stan, can you hear me? Are we still connected?
Randy, go ahead. Now, I wanted to ask how the recall for Governor Davis was going and if they could get petitions at your website.
Yes. Can you hear me all right?
You're doing fine.
Please visit our website, savecalifornia.com. Savecalifornia.com. The petition to recall Governor Gray Davis. Dr. Stan, it's going quite well, actually. They've collected one-third of the signatures needed. Today, there was a 32% still listed. That's a two-day-old figure. And I know, based on their progress, that they're probably at 35% right now of the signatures needed. And Governor Gray Davis has gotten so nervous, he has hired a political consultant to run his anti-recall campaign. So if you haven't yet signed the petition, go to savecalifornia.com, print it, sign it, return it. If you've already signed the petition but want to encourage others to sign it, then download the petition and take it to your friends, neighbors, family members, and collect signatures. That's how we do things in our civilization called California, and we need to stand up for what's right for the sake of the children.
All right, fine. Again, that's savecalifornia.com is the website. Anything else you wanted to say, Randy?
Well, Dr. Stan, keep up the great work. I do want to commend you for what you're doing and how you're leading. And I pray for God's best for you to keep your voice strong. And I do want to say that we also got a great apparent victory, a sex survey bill that allowed these terrible questions to be asked of children in public schools behind the backs of parents. It looks like that bill is stalled. You can read about it on our website, again, savecalifornia.com. But we must be in the battle. We can't just whine. We can't just be informed. We've got to use our concerns and use the information we have in order to step forward with deeds of faith. We must have an active faith. And Dr. Stan, I know that's what you encourage constantly.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Randy.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Of course, that was Randy Thomason of the Campaign for California Families. And Randy does a great, great, great job. And we're always so pleased to have him on with us. So, let's see. I assume that Randy is no longer there on line three. So we should be getting Brad Dacus before long. And Brad is with the Pacific Justice Institute, a young man who has foregone all the profits of being a lawyer to take on a ministry to represent Christians here in the West and actually anywhere across the country if they are coming under personal attack because of their faith, their religious faith issues, communities, school boards, teachers, anybody who, of course, is persecuted for their faith can get help at the Pacific Justice Institute. And, of course, the person you contact there is none other than Brad Dacus. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Oh, doing great, Dr. Stanley.
Well, how's the battle going today?
Well, it's going just great. We, as you may know, we just had a recent appearance before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in our case defending San Jose Christian College when they were wrongfully denied a use permit by the intolerant town of Morgan Hill. And this is a major case. We thought we took it on appeal. We're representing them without charge. And we brought up our stellar appellate attorney, John Dodd, from Orange County, to the oral argument. And I am pleased to announce, we don't know the results of it, but I'm pleased to announce that it's looking pretty good for us. According to John Dodd, the three judge panel seemed to understand the arguments, understand our points, and really nailed the other side. And just a little sample, the other side was arguing that our client has to show that there were repeated violations of their constitutional rights in order for them to be able to bring an action or a lawsuit for protection. And I think the judges understood that the Constitution doesn't have to be repeatedly violated for an individual to be able to seek relief in a federal court. All it takes is one violation of constitutional right to be able to do that. I think they understood that, and that's so I would appreciate your audience to keep them and our clients in your prayers and to pray for the Ninth Circuit that they will come down, that they'll have a good decision that could help set some great case law.
All right, now, what was the basis of this? This wasn't where they wanted to utilize the local hospital, was it there?
Right, and it's a vacant building, and there's no, and according to the objective state of California that is an assessment, there's no need for that to be an active hospital because there's one just a couple of miles down. Which is itself is not fully being utilized, and that's why it's vacant.
Basically, of course, there was this a Christian school that wanted a Christian college that wanted to have it, or what?
Right. It was a Christian college that wanted to move in there. Now, since that time, they've actually found a building four times the size in Rockland, which is near Sacramento. And it's even better, so God knows what he's doing when they didn't get what they wanted initially. But nonetheless, they're in agreement with us that it's real important that future churches and colleges dealing with intolerant communities like Morgan Hill, that they not get away with this. And so we're hoping to set some really strong case law for every religious institution in the entire West Coast, and hopefully we're going to prevail. We put a lot of work, a lot of time into this, and as we do in our cases, and we're hoping the Ninth Circuit will rule out for justice.
And for our listeners out there, of course, the owner of this building wanted to sell it. This Christian group wanted to buy it, and of course, the local board, I guess it was the planning board, or perhaps was that the city council?
Yeah, then the city council made the final decision, right?
All right, fine. And basically what they said was, we don't want this here. We might need a hospital at some time in the future. So the man who has the building can't sell it. The Christians can't buy it because we know it's best. And, of course, it was really a case of anti-Christian bigotry.
Absolutely. There is no question in any of our minds that that's the reason why it was denied, because it's just sitting there. It's not being used, and no one else has any use for it. So, it's a real injustice, but we are excited that we think we might be able to set some good case law, even a partial reversal of the lower court by the Ninth Circuit hearing this case could just have a major impact on our ability and our struggle to continue to further expand the rights of religious institutions on the West Coast and the rest of the country, for that matter.
All right, fine. Well, let's get out your website. Let's get out your telephone number, so if people want to get in touch with you, they can.
You bet. Our telephone number is 888-305-9129, 888-305-9129. And our webpage, where people can sign up to get our press releases hot off the press via email without charge, that's at www.pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org. And if anyone needs assistance, we do all of our work without charge. And there's a real struggle with the legislature. As you know, Dr. Stanley, that one nice thing we do have, we still have a court system that is there for us to use to get the justice that we can't get in our legislature.
All right. Well, God bless you. Thanks very much, Brad.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Brad Dacus of the Pacific Justice Institute. So, there are a lot of good things that are going on, and we are, our friends are having an impact out across America. Those of you who heard our last hour with Catherine Albrecht, she has a great organization going across America. She's going after her PhD at Harvard. But of course she, I would say, agrees, we would tend to agree with her position. And it's great to know we have people like that, that are really in the battle with us. And the more and more people, I think, are beginning to realize, that there is a definite attack on our freedom. Well, right now we have with us Vernon, and, Vernon is a well-known local radio personality, good friend, and we wanted to talk to him about the local school bonds. Now, all across America, why the local communities are having problems. They were spending money like it was going out of style when times were good, and they didn't remember the story about the little squirrel who always put something away for the wintertime. No, we were going to spend everything we possibly could lay our hands on. We were going to increase the pensions for everybody and the benefits for everybody and the salaries for everybody, and we were going to give money away like it was going out of style because there would always be more money the next year. Well, unfortunately, the next year has come, and our economy is in contraction. A lot of people are laid off of work. The local communities are not getting all the big grants from the state government, which is limited as far as its income, because its income taxes are down, and its sales taxes are down. And so now the local community is beginning to moan and groan. And, of course, the local school board always wants more money. Now, why anybody would want to reward a school system that has failed as miserable as the American school system, I don't know. A system where the children know far more about sex than they do about Shakespeare, where they know far more about global warming than they do about geography and geology, and a system aimed at destroying their faith in God and family and country. They are, of course, indoctrinated in internationalism, but, of course, you wouldn't expect the schools to admit that there's a problem. No, no, the problem is we need more money. And so there is an effort locally to ask for a special bond issue. How is it going to be handled, Vernon?
Well, it's a special ballot measure requiring 2/3 vote for a parcel tax, Dr. Stan. And you said something. You just said that the economy may be in contraction, but I'm going to tell you, government spending is not.
Right.
It is not in contraction. So, coming up in less than 2 weeks, actually a week from Tuesday, the voters will go to the ballot box and vote for or against Measure B,
Now, but one of the things they put on that is if you're over a certain age, why, of course, you're going to have to pay that if you ask not to be. In other words, it's to get the older people to vote for it because it's not going to cost them anything, which is illegal, but they don't care whether it's legal or not. They want to win because they want the money.
Why do you say it's illegal, Dr. Stan?
My understanding is, of course, you cannot allow one group to have special privileges, not have to pay the taxes if other people are going to have to pay them. Why don't you go into the background?
Well, are you talking about Article 1, Section 7, which says a citizen or class of citizens may not be granted privileges or immunities not granted on the same terms to all citizens?
That sounds pretty good.
From the California State Constitution? You know, I really wish we could challenge them on that, because this really is a winning formula when you enroll or enlist the assistance of seniors to vote for something they don't have to pay for, because most seniors don't want to sound like they're against schools, and they will be labeled that if they don't vote for the measure. And yet, that's a special privilege, absolutely a special privilege. So I think you brought it up, it was marked in my Constitution, and that's not where I would have started the conversation, but I think it's absolutely 100% unconstitutional, and I would like to actually challenge it on that basis.
All right, why don't you just pick up and tell our listeners the story of what this is all about, and of course, why they are cutting back on spending at our local school board.
Well, I think you just got it wrong again, Dr. Scan, which amazes me from a person of your
Vernon, don't you know that I'm asking a leading question so that
yes,
you can count
them?
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
All right, fine.
Getting back on spending, no, they have not cut one red cent on spending, and in fact, spending on schools has gone up unquestionably every year since 1997. In fact, the whole century, I think it has, but with respect to what we've got going on right now, school spending has gone out of hand. We have gone from spending around $4,800 per student to $7,200 per student per year, which is a pretty big jump, in my opinion.
Over how long a period?
Oh, that's been since about 1998 till 2002, 2003.
No, we must be getting a lot better education then.
Well, I don't... That is questionable, but the fact of the matter is these property tax measures have been pushed on the people based on the fact that they state that enrollments are down, so that revenues are down, and revenues are not down. Number one, no matter what they say they are cutting with respect to budget spending, and they're not cutting any spending, and that's what the listening audience really needs to realize is that. Budgets are nothing more than wish lists and proposed spending. So anything they cut is off of proposed spending. It's much like the county at large that cuts positions that were never filled and tells you that it will be spending less money when it's in fact spending more money. And the same thing with the schools. There is not one objective source, whether it be the Santa Cruz City School District website itself, or the California Department of Education website that gives any credence to the fact that there's been less spent on schools at all over the last 5 years. In fact, spending has continually gone up, and I believe that you would note that the governor has restored funding to schools as well.
Well, of course, he's buying it. He's borrowing that money from future generations, but he's another. I think he just borrowed an extra $6 billion so he could give money to schools so they wouldn't have to, of course, cut back on their smaller class size and all of these things.
Well, but there's no need to cut. Listen, if they were able to have smaller class sizes in 2000, 2001, or 1999, 2000, with less revenue coming in, why can't they do it in 2003, 2004 with more revenue coming in?
Because they've got less students. I mean, that's obviously the answer.
There's something very strange. I don't understand. What I don't understand is how people can buy that sales job. And Glenn Schaller, who happens to be one of the proponents, he was on KSCO, one of the other radio stations, as you know, a couple weeks ago, and what he said was, and I want to quote him. He was very proud that I quoted him on a radio interview on KUSP, and I made this quote. But I think that you'll see why I think this is so dangerous. He says, one of the problems with a funding crisis, now, first of all, it's not a crisis, but that's the jargon and terminology they wish to use, is that people start focusing on their individual problems rather than the larger solution. One of the things that is exciting about Measure B is that it is not just dealing with a funding crisis. It is part of a larger vision for our school districts. We're moving forward with new pre-kindergarten programs. There's a new immersion bilingual program starting at Branch 40 Elementary School. People are talking about marketing our schools so that people know the choices they have available between public schools and private schools, so that there is a new vision that's moving forward in our district that Measure B is a part of. And if anyone that reads the ballot measure, there's no language in there that says, please vote for a parcel tax to fund our new vision for the school system. Not once does it say, fund a new vision.
And basically what you're saying is they've got all these crazy new programs coming in, not necessarily going to teach reading and writing and arithmetic, not going to teach phonics or sound math. They want, of course, to get them into bilingual education and, of course, this continual indoctrination of our youth and visioning a better future, but not necessarily providing it. Do you have a figure on, say, how much they were spending for the Santa Cruz schools in the year 2000 and 2001, 2002, and then how much they intend spending this next year and how much is the enrollment actually down?
Well, I have all those. I'll have to jump around. 2001, 2002, the school district was funded to the tune. This is money they actually received. Is about almost $55 million.
$55 million. Okay.
Right. Now, that is, by the way, I actually want to go back. This might sound a long ways back, but I don't think so for our audience. In 1996-97, the receipts, the amount of money they took in, the amount they got from the state and from all sources, was $43 million.
All right.
So that is a fairly healthy jump. They proposed to spend In 2002, 2003, it was up to $60 million. If you go to the school website, it's really interesting. Their total revenues for 2002, 2003 were $56,754, and I can go in the cents. The total outgo was $60
million. In other words, they spent more than they took in.
Yeah, they spent more than they took in, despite the fact that they had declining enrollment.
Now, how much is the enrollment down?
The enrollment is down. I have to pull that. The enrollment is down about 1,000 students.
All right.
I could pull the exact number up for you. It would take a second. But it's down about 1,000 students. There's another interesting thing here that I don't think a lot of people realize, Dr. Stan.
All right.
They spent more than they budgeted for, which is important to know.
Okay.
And they spent more than they got. actually, not more than they budgeted for. I don't know what they budgeted that year, but they spent more than they got. But they're, hang on a second.
Well, I think the interesting thing is if enrollment is down 1,000 students, and let's average $5,000 per student. I know it's up to about $7,000 a year, but at $5,000 a student, that would be about $5 million that they would have saved. At $7,000 a student, would be $7 million that they would save. So actually, they could actually cut their expenditures by about $7 million, but obviously they have no intention of doing that, do they?
Well, they absolutely, they have no intention whatsoever of doing that, and they continue to yell at people that they, don't have enough because they've got budget deficits. And I think it's what's really important that I cannot hammer home enough is that a budget deficit is nothing more than the gap between what you got coming in and what you want to spend. And you can make that number up. It's off of projected. I keep saying, like, the county cuts positions it never filled. If you doubled your budget next year, You just made your budget twice as much as you had coming in. Just made it up. And then cut that doubling in half, you'd still have a budget deficit, even though you planned on spending more money that you couldn't spend. I tell people I run a $10 million a year budget deficit, Dr. Stan. I got $10 million worth of stuff I want to spend money on that I don't have the money for.
Well, okay. What you're
you
saying.
You understand what I'm saying?
Of course, it's just sort of a wish list. You'd like to have that money to spend, but last year they only spent $56 million.
No, they spent $60 million.
They spent $60 million.
They got $56 million. They spent $60.
So where did they get the extra $4 million?
In other words, well, I think
did they borrow it? Or
they
did
borrowed
they have,
it from the...
Or do they have a slush fund like so many people do, and they don't want the people to know about it?
Well, you know... If to talk about school districts is to talk about slush funds, Dr. Stan. You know, they have money stashed in every nook and cranny you could think of, much like an alcoholic that's got something stashed every place. You know, they've got money stashed in, by the way, they've got it stashed every place. And they pad the budgets, number one. And they got additional money last year from Measures C and D as well.
All right, now what was Measure C and Measure D last year?
Measure C and D were a property tax measure that they had on the ballot last year.
And so they got more money from us last year?
Yes, they did. To the tune of about, for the school, the elementary schools, which is what this one is for, that property tax was, I think, $70 per parcel.
And of course, now they want an additional $80 parcel, is that right?
It's $80, yeah, $81 per year per parcel to keep schools open. It's very interesting that I wrote an op-ed, or Carolyn Bussenhart and I wrote an op-ed for the Santa Cruz City Sentinel, and as we said, that there's no objective source that he ever says they're short of any money or revenue. That's why these people want to talk about budget deficits. But can I introduce something else here?
You can do whatever you want to.
Okay.
There are no rules and regulations on this interview tonight.
Well, I love it. But we've all heard the governor talk about his current budget, correct?
Right.
In the state budgetary crisis and everything. I believe that last year the state budget was right around $100 billion. And this year, the governor has proposed to spend $98 billion in his budget. Are we going to a break?
Oh, we've got about 45 seconds.
Okay. Now, the other thing, if you read, the papers have said that the governor has slashed $38 billion from the budget. The only way the governor could slash $38 billion from a budget is for the legislature and the governor to have planned on spending $136 billion this year, $36 billion more than we spent last year, a 36% increase in 1 year in a proposed wish list.
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Vernon, and we'll welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you agree or disagree, let's hear from you. this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest is Vernon, and we're talking about, and of course those of you who don't know Vernon, he's a frequent caller and a well-known talk show host on KSCO in town here. And of course, we'd welcome your calls. If you have any thoughts on the tax, maybe you think we need more money for the schools. Maybe you think we do not need so much money for the schools. Maybe if they would get back to sound fundamentals instead of all the death education and values clarification and sex education, and so much of the time is wasted. All we need to do is to compare the government that's trained children to children who go to homeschools, why it's always the homeschooled children who get the best spelling bee scores and geography scores. And yes, occasionally you'll find a student who goes to the government schools who comes out pretty well balanced, but an awful lot of them have some real serious problems because they've destroyed their sense of values. And I will tell you, I've talked to young people who've been through schools here in Santa Cruz. It took them 20 years after they got out of school before they could see the world as it really was, because the schools were used to indoctrinate them in socialism and collectivism and internationalism and environmentalism and sexism and immorality. And it takes a long time to undo all of the harm that has been done by the educational system. So I'll pick it up from there, Vernon.
Well, yeah, notwithstanding that, the thing that I would like the listening audience to realize is that school spending has continued to go up dramatically over the last 2, 3, 4 years, so that even with the drop in enrollments, and even if parents want to retain the class sizes of 20 that they say they wish to retain, when you look at what the schools take in terms of revenue, they're getting in more this year than they did last year, than they did the year before. There's really no need that I can see, given the revenues that they take in, to even close the schools. Now, it makes sense that when your enrollments drop, like any business, the biggest cost of any educational facility is our personnel. It may make sense to close the school. Nevertheless, I don't believe it's even necessary to close schools, and that's one of the things that they're going after the parents for. There's another issue that's related to this, though, by the way, is in the every credible study has shown that until you get class sizes below 15 or so kids per class, you show no performance difference. And so consequently, you know, this whole hype, as far as I'm concerned, about going from class sizes of 30 to 20 is a waste of money.
Well, not only that, but my wife went to a school where I think there were 40 or 50 kids in a class, and she got an excellent education. Over in India, they'll have 50 to 75 students in a class, superior education. In fact, many of the students, who can't get into the better Indian schools in India, come over here to MIT or to Columbia University there, into our finest colleges. But it has nothing to do with class size. It has to do with, of course, discipline and emphasis on excellence rather than emphasis on mediocrity like we have.
Actually, I'll put on my liberal hat for a second, Dr. Stan. I would actually argue, if you want to argue from the perspective of the liberal bent, who talk about the beauty of diversity, don't you have a greater probability of having a more diverse class if you have a larger class size? And doesn't that, in effect, do a better job of preparing students for going out into a world wherein they can't control the size of the group of people, for the most part, that they have to interact with or engage in the workforce? By the way, when they go on to college, I can guarantee you that most of the kids that enter a freshman chemistry class at UCSC will be in class sizes of 250 to 500 students for a freshman chemistry class. So how is a class size of 20 preparing kids for the realities of life? If you really wish to evoke those arguments, if there's no consistency to the discussion. But back to Measure B. We have been so, the main thing that I would say to people, there are many arguments against voting for Measure B, the property tax, but I, if nothing else, the fact is that someone's trying to sell us something based on something that's not true. In other words, that their revenues are down, because class sizes are down, which is just a literal lie, is reason enough to not vote for it. You don't need to go beyond that. When someone tries to sell you a product based on its properties, and you go and it doesn't do what they say it does, then you don't buy it. They're trying to tell us that the revenues are down because enrollments are down. Revenues are way up, notwithstanding the excessive wasteful spending that they've conducted for the last 3 to 5 years. When they budget $56 million or $55 million and spend $60 million, that's just absolutely irresponsible. And one of the places that they do borrow, too, people need to know, is they're borrowing from the teachers. They're literally borrowing from the teacher retirement funds as well.
They're borrowing from the teachers' retirement funds. How can they do that? I thought that was illegal.
Well, that part you got me. And there's another thing that I don't think that I don't know if you've ever discussed this. The way the state allows the schools to calculate the budget, it allows them to project their incoming revenues on the next year's enrollments, which have been decreasing. I think you've realized that. But they allow them to calculate their next year's needs on the current enrollments. So that if you can calculate your budgetary needs or class needs or expenditure needs on what your class sizes are this year, if you had 100 kids in school this year and you thought it was going to drop to 80 next year, if you can calculate your needs based on 100 students, but your revenues based on 80, you've cooked the books to the tune of 20 students. The law allows the school district not only to work from a wish list, propose spending, but to cook the books as well. I think that's absolutely fascinating to me because the school districts and the municipalities have it all over the Enrons they like to point fingers on. Talk about creative bookkeeping or budgeting. These people can build in a deficit, cry wolf, go to the taxpayers, and tug on the taxpayer heartstrings, and then they get, as far as I'm concerned, a worthless politician like Bruce McPherson and John Laird, who pat themselves on the back for passing off taxation as support of schools. They support taxation. They support these taxation measures because they're not doing their job. Actually, they are doing their job in Sacramento. They're not doing their job on one hand, but on the other they are because the schools are getting all the revenue.
Well, what is this about the school giving $1 million to a multimillionaire named O'Neill? What was that story?
You know, I don't know anything about that one. I'm sorry. I would be out of my element there unless they rented or borrowed back money from him. But you know, there's. Listen, on Radio Liberty, I can say something I have a hard time saying on other. Well, I don't have a hard time saying. But I get chastised from other shows. Is a tremendous one of the expenditures in the public school system from K through 12 is adult education. Now, if the school district, if elementary education wants to raise money for adults that didn't get it the first time in the school system, you know, and they want to raise property taxes for that, they should say so. But from my perspective, is if they're going to cry wolf to the extent they have, which we've shown that they have plenty of money, is then it seems to me, why don't we require adults who've already had an opportunity or their shot at the school system to pay for whatever they want? Why should we be re-educating adults or people that come here illegally on public funds under the guise of an elementary school budget?
Now, are they allowing people who are here illegally to attend the adult education classes?
Well, I don't, you know, I would, anyone can sign up for adult education, I believe, but why is the adult education funded from the elementary school budget?
All right, that's a very, very legitimate. Now, is this elementary school or is this high school?
Well, the Santa Cruz City School District is merged in terms of those.
All right,
two.
Fine. So basically, of course, they're asking for the people to vote. Now, do they need a two-thirds vote or a 60% vote?
They need a two-thirds on this one.
All right, fine. So they need a two-thirds vote. It's going to be about a week or two now?
Well, a week from next Tuesday.
Oh, is there any opposition to this?
Well, you know, for the first time, I've gotten people calling me that haven't been nasty. I've had very supportive calls saying that they've had it with the school district, they've had it with the spending, they don't understand it, and which is very unusual in this town. You typically get calls like, you know, what is it that you hate about children? You know, you've got yours. You know, it's easy for you to say that kind of stuff, but this is not about the children. By the way, when the paper can talk about the schools can't supply the children with pencils and paper, I find that ludicrous that anyone would even read that kind of stuff.
Well, of course they're going to read it because they print it in the paper, but then, you know, they can print anything they want to in the paper because they own it.
But I'm surprised it would sell, Dr. Stan. When's the last... Do you buy paper for KFER up there?
Sure.
Is it real expensive?
No, it's very, very cheap.
You know, I can
get out of Costco and we get it there by the box full.
You probably get 10 reams, that's 5,000 sheets of paper, and the last time I bought 10 reams, it was about $18. $18 for 5,000 sheets. Pencils are equally cheap. You know, what people don't understand is that the per student expenditure on materials, I think, is around $35 or $40 a student.
But wait a minute, you're telling me they're spending over $7,000 a student now.
Yeah, I know, but that's what they spend on materials. Around $35 a student.
What about cutting back somewhat on the administration? Because that's where most of the money goes, into the administration.
No, most of it goes in teachers, really, believe it or not. This is something that people misunderstand, is that for everyone, if you have one administrator at 90 to 150,000, you can pick any one of those. They figure, I think it's around 100,000, they figure, for a principal. It only takes two teachers at the average salary of about 48 grand a year for the school district to equal one principal. So there are five or six principals in the elementary school district. The expense really is in teachers. And I know that there are teachers out there. I'm not trashing teachers, but like any business, the biggest cost of education is personnel, and the biggest cost of personnel is that part with the most bodies, which happens to be teachers.
All right, fine. How much does a average teacher get here in the school system?
$48,000 a year. They budget $60,000 a year for a teacher. The average salary, I think, is around $48,000.
All right, fine. And how many students in a class?
Well, they're running around 20 students. Well, in the K through 4, it's around 20 students, and they're up to 28 in the high schools, which is actually less students than were in my high school classes, in grade school classes. You know,
It looks to me like if I calculate that out, that's $140,000 for every class of 20 students at $7,000 a student. Would that be right?
That's
$140,000, of which the teacher gets $48,000. Who's getting all the rest?
Well, I could pull that number up. It turns out the teachers make about 68%. The classified, the unclassified, which are the other people in the administration, from the cafeteria workers, groundskeepers, and stuff, they're about another 15 to 20% here. If you gave me a second, I could pull it up. I'm pulling these off the top of my head so people can... I ask them to deal with this loosely. The bottom line is the amount that dribbles down to the classroom and the kids in terms of supplies and everything is like 7 to 10%.
All right. Well, by the way, the
state, I want to tell people, listen, don't believe me. I'm telling everyone, don't believe Vernon out here. Don't believe Dr. Stan. Don't believe Carolyn Busenhart, who does these things with me. Don't believe Dick Moss. Go to the sources. Go to the California Department of Education website and look up the numbers yourself. Look up the figures. Look at what's spent on public schools. You know, they have a formula. The last one that they did is they figure that the cost to run a school is $4.5 million for a school of around 692 students with class sizes of 21. Is that pretty straightforward?
Well, that seems pretty straightforward.
Could you calculate that?
Well, I probably could, but I mean, what are you looking at?
Well, I'm just looking at if you run the numbers on that one, you can find that our school district is overspending what it needs to spend anyway. It's getting in more money than it should require to run its schools.
All right, fine. So in other words, we are wasting a lot of money, but we have a vision. Isn't that why we're spending so much money?
No, it depends on who you talk to. Remember, the school districts never talk in terms of what they receive in terms of income. They talk about what they're short in terms of their wish list or their budget.
Well, I think we have a problem because I don't think that they will ever have enough money. And I can remember ever since I've been in Santa Cruz, and that is close to 50 years, that there's always been this undertone of demanding more money. I can remember when they wanted to tear down Santa Cruz High back, 40 years ago. Oh, we've got to tear it down and put in a new building. Why? Because they just want to run up the tax bases. I hear they. In fact, I can remember the radical leftists, in fact, some of them were frank communists on the school board, and their goal was to tear down Santa Cruz High because it was an earthquake trap, all the things wrong with it. That building is as solid now as it ever was 40 years later. But they don't want a solution. They want a problem. That's what it's all about.
Well, you know, people can go to, I'll give out a website here because, you know, one of the things, beauties of this day and age in radio is when you call me, I can be online. Is if people want to go to www.cde.ca.gov/fiscal/financial/, there's a wealth of data. There's K-12 financial data, okay, which gives the average salaries. For example, if you were to look at 1996-97, it would tell you the average salary for the elementary school districts, the high school districts statewide for comparison. At the very bottom, it tells you the income for public education K-12, 1996-97.
Now, what is the average cost for a school, for a student across the state? Do we have any idea?
I don't have that one in front of me. But, you know, that's irrelevant. It's a non sequitur. The bottom line is that the question I want to ask people is how much more does it cost to teach a child in K-3, that's what Measure B is about, to read, write, and do some arithmetic. How much more does it cost today than it did 10 years ago even?
Well, of course, your figures you were using was 97 and comparing that with, of course, the present time in 97 with more students. It cost $43 million, and of course now...
What is mechanically... Listen, to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, some very basic skills, those are some of the skills that the kids in K-1 through 3 learn. Why is it so expensive? You know, you Run Spot Run, CJ and Run, some of those books and stuff, I was reading by the time I was 5 years old, not at the level I can today. You know, before we ever got here, you know, Abraham Lincoln, some of our great people in this country, learned to read, write, do arithmetic without an elaborate school system. I want to know the question that I just asked, and I'll ask it again, is why is it so expensive? Why is the cost of teaching kids to read, write, and do arithmetic going up so dramatically? In fact, the state spent $36 billion on education in 1996-97. Given what I've been talking about, in the last figure they got posted, they spent $55 billion in 2001-2002. Now, that's not that long of a time period, Dr. Stan. 97 to 2001-2002, I want to know what warranted spending $20 billion more. That's a 40% increase.
Well, you know, Vernon, a government's like a hungry lion. It just never has enough to eat.
Well, even hungry lions get satiated. It's more like that little plant in the time-aged movie, Little House of Horrors. You remember that one?
I really don't.
Well, it's a very simple thing. Someone finds this plant in his shop. It's a cult film, Dr. Stan, and I know you don't bother with that kind of stuff. But it's a little plant. It starts off the size of maybe a hand. And the first words out of its mouth are, feed me. Feed me. And throughout the whole movie, as he feeds the plant, it gets bigger, and it keeps saying, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me. The reason I say the numbers, I want to put it very simply to people, is that if you listen to the news media, if you listen to local papers, if you listen to the television, the radios, and all that, what you consistently hear is that school funding's being cut from all sources, federal, state, local. What's being cut is their wish list. They're always spending more. Government talks about budgets because it doesn't want to confront the fact that's really important is, are you spending more this year than last year? And by how much? You can't spend more than you make, I don't think. If you figure out a way to do that, actually there's a way to do that. If you can get the public to fund KFER, you might be able to do it.
Well,
is that making any sense at all? I go nuts. I don't understand it. The news media, they're either ignorant. Actually, they're ignorant, lazy, and they may actually be in collusion because you read the news media and they talk about the financial problems and stuff. These are all financial problems that are made up. It's a function of having, you know, a caviar appetite on a... I don't even have a good analogy for it, Dr. Stan. State spending, I don't know if you realize this, the state of California, our budget has gone from $4 billion when I graduated, 65, to over 100.
Well, I tell you what, that sounds like you really should have got a government job then.
I know, from $4 billion in 1965 to over $100 billion. That translates to an ongoing rate of government spending in the state of California alone at the rate of about 14% per annum for the last 40 years. And if you look at the rate of, because people always ask me, well, have you adjusted for inflation? Well, I'm just going to tell you, when it's that, as Bob Dylan used to say, when something's not right, it's wrong. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. And I can't get you to admit to me that $55 million the school was spending last year is more than $43 million next year, we can't even move on.
Now, wait a minute. $55 last year, and
their budget was $55. They spent $60.
Right.
Okay.
And what do they have budgeted for this year?
They're starting out, I think, about $57 million, but their enrollments are down. This is all funny money. If you got a raise, if you made $20 an hour, if you paid Vernon $20 an hour to come work for you at KFER. And you said, you know what, I want to give you a raise to $120 an hour. I would be thrilled. But you know what, if you had to cut it next year to $100 an hour, I'd still be thrilled and would not whine to you that I'd had my income cut.
Well, I'll tell you what, Vernon, there's no chance you're going to get a job here at that service. In fact, we don't pay any salaries here. Everything is volunteer.
What you need to look at in terms of financially, whether it be the stock market, whether it be government spending or anything, you've got to look at things. And you can't just look at what's going on right now. You need to look at in the long, you know, period of time.
Well, I think that if their budget last year was $55 million, $55 million last year, and this year it's going to be $57 million, but they're down 1,000 students. That should be far, far less than
it should be. If you did all of the calculations right, their budgets right now for the students they have, based on reasonable rates of inflation and what the state of California says it takes to run a school. I'll put it that way. The school district budgets right now should be around $52 to $53 million.
All right, fine. And now, are they expanding the adult education courses? Is this part of what they're up to?
I don't know that that's what they're part of, but you can go down to the school district and find out what they spend money on. And in one chunk, in any given, in a 2-week period I picked up, it's been a year ago, was had a pretty good chunk for adult education. And I thought, well, you know, if you don't have money to educate the little ones, the little kids, the age of my granddaughters, then, you know, I'm sorry, the people that dropped out of school just going to have to wait or ante up.
Well, that's Keith has a question. Keith, you have a question or comment?
Yeah, a question. I was listening, and I guess Vernon got his numbers from the State Department of Education. Have you looked at their capital reports?
I don't have their capital report, no.
Because every school, well, federal law states that every school district, school, city council, water district, everybody has to have a comprehensive annual financial report. And that's it's the details, not their budget. It's what money they actually take in and what money they spend.
And of course, how much money they have salted away in all these other accounts,
yeah.
Right?
I'll never forget, he's dearly departed now, the father of a very good friend of mine who was a colonel in the U.S. Air Force, that said when I was a young man, he says, Vernon, accounting's pretty straightforward. You got money in and money out. The rest is just details and categories. And what the school districts, the government at large is very good at is creating a lot of categories to obfuscate things, to cloud the issues. And then they work on wish lists. They have sold the public a bill of goods and having the public believe that their budget means anything. A budget is a wish list. It's,
yeah.
And any cuts are off proposed spending, not money already spent. And if you look at any budget after the fiscal year, virtually every government entity always overspends what it budgeted for.
I think that we have a lot of people that do bookkeeping just like Enron does. And Keith, I tried to get hold of the local CAFER report for our county, and of course I think they had the thing all doctored. I was told that several years ago they had honest ones, and then when they found that people were beginning to look at them, they began to doctor them. So you really can't tell anything about it. It's not an honest CAFER report, because many of our municipalities do have money in other accounts, and they just don't put it in any longer.
What if you or I did that? Wouldn't that be illegal?
Well, I know, but of course, who are you going to complain to, the government? Hey, thanks very much, Keith. We're out of time.
Yeah, the bottom line is, by the way, Enron could learn some things about creative bookkeeping from the federal government, the school districts. Bottom line is there's no need for additional funds. There's no need to double the school property tax revenues over 2 years to vote on Measure B. People need to vote no on that thing.
All right,
they need to hold the administrators and the trustees accountable. They need to start going to their school board meetings and saying, wait a second, why are you unable to do what you were able to do 2 years ago now with more revenue?
And with, of course, less students.
That's right.
All right, God bless you. Thanks very much. Give my best to Carolyn.
Will do.
Appreciate you being with us. So,
thank you, Dr.
Bye.
Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Vernon. Vernon's been with us. It's always a pleasure. And you're going to have to decide what you want to do about the vote, but I just wanted to perhaps get more information for my own edification on what's happening here in my community and the same things that happen all across the country. As I said, government like a hungry lion just never has enough. Well, we'll be back tomorrow at the same time. Until then, may the Lord be with you.